The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
This program was sponsored by Random House.
Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents with historian and best-selling author Alexander Rose. I'm your host, Ken Clark, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago, and it's made possible through the generous support of Random House. This program, and more than 400 others covering a full range of military topics, is available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. The most important factor in any battle is the human one. It is the individual soldier, as much as any general in command, who proves decisive in combat. In his new work, Men of War, The American Soldier in Combat at Bunker Hill, Gettysburg, and Iwo Jima, author Alexander Rose chronicles war through the eyes of the American soldiers who fought in three of our most iconic battles. Exploring the idea that combat encompasses both unadulterated terror and grinding boredom, Rose draws on an immense range of firsthand sources from the battlefield to develop an original look at ordinary soldiers under fire. At Bunker Hill, the bloodiest clash of the American Revolution, Rose takes us to a lost and alien world of 18th century warfare. Here, he reveals why American militiamen were so lethally effective against the oncoming waves of British troops. At Gettysburg, Rose describes a typical Civil War infantry action, vividly explaining what Union and Confederate soldiers experienced before, during, and after combat. Finally, he shows how in 1945, the Marine Corps hurled itself at the island of Iwo Jima, where nearly a third of all Marines killed in World War II would die. To an unprecedented degree, Men of War brings home the reality of combat and, just as important, its aftermath in the form of psychological and medical effects on the veterans. It narrows the gap between the popular understanding of the wars and the experiences of the soldiers who fight them. Alexander Rose is the author of Washington Spies, the story of America's first spy ring, which inspired the AMC original series Turn, Washington Spies. His other works include American Rifle and Kings in the North. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, Alexander Rose.
Hi. Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for coming out on this beautiful day. And before we start, I just have to make a remark that please excuse my rather hoarse voice. I'm getting over a cold from last week. So let us start. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you again for that wonderful introduction. I think it's one of those times I wish my parents were here, in that after hearing that, my mother would be very well. My father would be very proud, I think, but my mother would actually believe it. Let me start here. A few years before World War I, the British writer G.K. Chesterton wondered how it was that nations warred with one another. It made no sense once you thought about it. After all, he pointed out, quote, a perfectly rational army would run away, end quote, when confronted by an opponent in the field. Yet they didn't. Instead, armies ignored the odds, refused to heed common sense, and stubbornly stood their ground, at grave personal risk and with often fatal consequences. Perfectly rational soldiers, seeing that death or dismemberment might well be their fate, should, logically speaking, throw away their weapons and hightail it to the rear. Yet if any soldier dared do so, he'd be smeared as a coward instead of congratulated for his otherwise sound sense of self-preservation and reluctance to lay down his life for little more than the king's shilling and a shiny medal. So when you look at it that way, well, war really is quite insane. Now, having myself emerged from some 5 years of research and reading on this very subject, a similar thing might be said of any historian who dares to examine what it's like being in a battle, the subject of Men of War. A perfectly rational writer, to paraphrase Chesterton, would, or at least should, run away very fast when confronted by such a monumental task. It also means that I'm slightly insane myself. Well, I'm glad I didn't run away, that is, for the study of men under fire is endlessly fascinating, and I hope I'll be able to convey some of that fascination in this talk this evening. Ultimately, the battles don't matter. Men of War is really a book about battle, not specific battles. Indeed, I give, as I said before, I give only the most bare bones of outlines for each clash at the beginning of each chapter. I do this deliberately. My thinking is that if one is interested in what happened at Gettysburg, then there are hundreds and hundreds of books that will enlighten you far more than I possibly could. My intent, remember, is to examine the phenomenon of combat as experienced by typical soldiers in an action typical of the time and place. Not, repeat, not the details of a particular person's responses to specific battles. Put another way, the experiences of a Marine at Iwo Jima are generally applicable or illustrative of those of his comrades fighting on the various Pacific islands, at the same time. And the same with Gettysburg, same with Bunker Hill. The individual battles I talk about, in other words, merely represent what it was like being in other battles taking place at the same time. They're basically a convenient container for a variety of different experiences. Keeping in mind that Men of War is a 400-odd-page book, and I have only a relatively brief time here to speak, but as we've said, there'll be questions afterwards, I hope. Let's summarize what we can learn from these three battles. At its most basic, how soldiers experience combat has three aspects: the personal, the environmental, and the psychological. So I'll kick off with the personal. In a nutshell, these are the things that happen within a person's body and what he's feeling when he's under fire. What we know for certain is that humans have been reacting the same way to combat since time immemorial. Primitive Homo sapiens, Homer's heroes, God's Israelites, Cyrus's Persians, Caesar's Romans, Charlemagne's knights, Napoleon's imperial guards, all of them could find common ground in this respect with the Americans at Bunker Hill, Gettysburg, and Iwo Jima. Fear, apprehension, dread, terror, all these feelings before and during combat are integral to humans. They're universal, in other words, but their effects may nevertheless be mitigated through training, drill, and experience. And that's one reason why, in the minutes leading up to combat, officers have traditionally directed their men to perform mundane tasks repeatedly. At Gettysburg, for instance, the 18th Massachusetts, awaiting Pickett's charge, performed the manual of arms, the series of motions by which soldiers loaded, fired, and recharged the weapons over and over and over and over again. Why? Because repetition is a form of mindlessness expressly designed to take soldiers' minds off what's to come. The thinking is that you can't be paralyzed with fear if you're focusing on equipment checks and cleaning your rifle for the seventh time. Still, in the heat of the fight, one's emotional state is more difficult to regulate. This is because emotions and feelings are conditioned, if not dictated, by bodily responses to combat. Basically, soldiers experience a host of potent physiological effects when they fight. Whereas a normal resting heart rate is between 60 and 80 beats per minute, pulse spikes allow individuals to reach their optimal combat performance level. Complex motor skills, visual reaction times, and cognitive reaction times hit their peak between about 115 and 145 beats per minute. That's basically what you would get to during a good hard workout at the gym. At that stage, they may feel, as one does at the gym after a good workout, as if they are invincible gods. Euphoria can be the result, and that's one reason why some soldiers, find combat narcotically addictive. Nevertheless, if stress levels continue to rise, so do heart rates. Between about 150 and 175 beats per minute, mental and physical abilities begin to deteriorate. The deficits on performance at this stage are greater than for major alcohol intoxication, drug sedation, or clinical hypoglycemia. Low blood glucose. Above 175 beats per minute, soldiers regress to infantility or animal instinct. Submissive behavior is often seen, and soldiers tend to lose control over their bowels and bladders. They will tend to freeze, torn between a desire to fight or flee. Headlong, unstoppable, unthinking flight frequently results. But if they do actually plunge ahead, on the attack. Their gross motor skills, charging and running and so forth, are at their zenith, and they may overwhelm enemy soldiers and perform unbelievable feats of courage. Mentally speaking, under conditions of high stress and extreme excitement, the way in which individuals process incoming sensory information alters as well. People think less rationally, less logically. Their deliberative and analytical skills rapidly eroding as their cortexes filter or tune out stimuli unessential to survival. Actions become automatic or instinctive. That's a kind of cognition known as experiential. The common symptom of operating in such mode, and this is where it gets very interesting, is that soldiers' sensory perceptions undergo severe distortion. Studies have found that at least half will experience the events in question in slow motion, a fifth in faster than normal time. Two-thirds will hear at diminished volume, meaning that the sound of close-by gunshots is greatly muffled or they may not hear them at all. And a fifth of all soldiers will hear things at amplified volume. About half will see what is happening around them with tunnel vision and black out everything to the sides. And the other half will see with amazingly heightened sort of cat-like clarity. Even odder, these symptoms often overlap, making combat seem a very, very weird experience indeed. Thus, according to one engineer on Iwo, Iwo Jima, quote, everything happened in slow motion. Small sounds are amplified, and the din of battle was silence. Your eyes saw everything. Your mind noted and remembered it all in minute detail, end quote. But the mind is cunning. Given the stress, the exhaustion, the startling sensory impacts and the hormone spikes, it's hardly surprising that soldiers' memories of what happens or happened are jerky and disordered, even if precise. The conventional linear progression that we take for granted in everyday life of past to present to future dissolves into a kind of a muddy sludge, periodically interrupted by disturbing flashbacks, out-of-order sequences, and fragmented recollections. Veterans can usually relate exactly what happened during particularly vivid events, but not when or where they occurred. On Iwo Jima, Gerald Averill, another Marine there, for instance, described the jarring moment when normal chronological continuity disappeared as resembling, quote, when a smoothly moving film on the screen changes to a series of color slides, some of them painfully acute, slide on, slide off, click, click, nothing in between, end quote. It is only much later, usually by retracing their steps or reading a general history of the battle, that soldiers can actually make sense of what happened or see the bigger picture or what on earth was going on around them, really. So at its simplest, then, I'll sum up very quickly. At its simplest, then, the personal or human aspect of combat is changeless. What about the environmental aspects of battle, then, the second type of experience that I mentioned before? By environmental, I mean external factors like noise, sights, smells, rituals, routines, and so forth. The stuff that happens around soldiers, not within them. Well, in a sentence, the more it changes, the more it stays the same. In other words, the environment of combat is both changeless and changing at the same time. I'll give you a few examples. Battles, I think we can all agree, are pretty noisy affairs. Gunfire, of course, always makes a racket. That hasn't changed since the Renaissance, when firearms first began making their appearance on European battlefields. So in that respect, nothing's changed. But what has changed is the quality of the noise one hears. For instance, the sound of a modern gunshot is very different from that at Gettysburg, let alone at Bunker Hill, mostly owing to developments in muzzle velocity, propellant, and bullet design. At Bunker Hill, because at that time musket rounds or balls traveled at less than the speed of sound, their subsonic approach, passage, and departure could be easily heard from several feet away. That's the reason why soldiers of the era often mention that in firefights, it sounded as if, as one Amos Farnsworth at Bunker Hill put it, quote, the balls sung like bees around our heads, end quote. So there was this distinctive buzzing sound when danger was near. In contrast, modern rounds tend to be supersonic. And as the bullet is traveling faster than the shockwave it generates, a person downrange simply cannot hear a bullet approaching. Only after it's passed, as indicated by the characteristic crack left in its wake. So when it comes to gunfire, we can say that everything's the same, only a little bit different. We can even go a little further here and add that a Bunker Hill militiaman who miraculously time-traveled to Iwo Jima would be surprised to find how relatively quiet the battlefield was, though he'd be astounded at the quantity of ammunition expended and, of course, how smokelessly clear it all was. Now, what about a ritual or mode of behavior that is also both changeless and changing? Let me focus on what I call the arming motif. In the Iliad, for instance, Paris, Agamemnon, Patroclus, and Achilles are all described magnificently loving detail, preparing their battle kit before combat. So here is Agamemnon, warlord of the Greeks, readying himself. First, he fitted about his legs ornate greaves with silver anklets. Then he strapped around his chest his breastplate, which was banded with 10 strips of blue enamel, 12 of gold, and 20 of tin. And on either side, 3 serpents writhed up towards the neck, then their glittering enamel like Zeus's rainbow in the sky. From his shoulder, he slung a sword, its gleaming hilt studded with gold, the scabbard silver hanging by golden chains. Then he took up his richly figured, silver-chained war shield, big enough to hide a man, with its 10 bronze circles and 20 gleaming bosses of white tin. On his head, he set his double-ridged, four-plated helmet with horsehair crest, its plume nodding savagely. Then he grasped 2 sharp and sturdy bronze-tipped spears, glittering so that they honored golden Mycenae's king. End quote. Oh, pretty miraculous stuff. But basically, it's greaves, breastplate, sword, shield, helmet, and grab some spears on your way out the door. It's a set routine. 3,000 years later, that ritual of armament is still with us. Here, for instance, is Sergeant David Belavius in Fallujah just a few years ago. Quote, "I threw on our full battle rattle, which included ballistic proof eye protection, smoke grenades for concealment, reinforced knee pads any skateboarder would envy, a 5-quart camelback reservoir of water, 35-pound interceptor ballistic armor fully loaded, 2.5-pound Kevlar helmet, night vision, grenades, weapon, and ammunition." So the equipment's changed a bit, of course, as has the language, but not the intent. The arming motif remains the solemn, sacred ceremony of the professional warrior before he enters the maelstrom. Psychologically, which is the third of our types of experience of combat, psychologically, however, it's a completely different story. How men think about combat, behave during it, and how they react to it is culturally and contextually conditioned and changes dramatically over time. Now, this is a complicated and controversial but very important point, so let me break it down a little bit. War, to a large extent, is culture. In some cultures, it is an almost bloodless ritual, as in the 17th century Native Americans on the East Coast that met the French and the Spanish. I remember reading a story where the Spanish or the French could just loose a couple of shots, and the Indians would be terrified. But what the Europeans found most fascinating was that when the Indians fought, they didn't really fight for blood. I mean, they took a couple of prisoners, and it was almost a kind of a odd sort of ritual between tribes. It was very different from the European way, which was basically of annihilation. But anyway, to continue, war is culture. In some cultures, it's an almost bloodless ritual, and in others, it's a profitable enterprise, as in the mercenaries who plagued the Italian city states during the Renaissance. And in still others, it's a religious calling, as we're discovering. And in a few, war is the culture itself, which, as in Nazi Germany, where the theme was of endless war against lesser races. So just as war changes over time and space, so too does the experience of combat, or more precisely, how soldiers think about their combat experience. A really good example, I think, is the phenomenon known as the baptism of fire, which is a staple of war literature and movies. You see it in every movie, Platoon, You know, Saving Private Ryan, everything like that. And in huge numbers of war memoirs from, you know, that one always reads. It refers to one's first exposure to combat. And we tend to assume that such an event is transformative, momentous, life-altering, revelatory of deeper truths of existence. It must be. It was always thus, and how could it not be? But the fact is, it's not. In the Middle Ages, for instance, no one made a big deal about the baptism of fire. Instead, youths bred since birth to war were naturally expected to win their spurs during their first battle, as the fearsome Edward III said of the 16-year-old Black Prince at Crecy. Put another way, being blooded was remarkable only because it proved that a baron or a prince was a deserving heir to his father and a worthy lord because it proved that a baron or a prince was a deserving heir to his father and a worthy lord paramount to the men. So there's nothing life-altering about it. It was more like passing a driving test so that dad will lend you the minivan keys. By the time we get to Bunker Hill in 1775, we are dealing with martial frontier societies existing in an almost constant state of low-level danger. It's often forgotten that during the French and Indian War, which took place, of course, just 20 years before the Revolution, that at least 40% of all Massachusetts males aged between 16 and 29 enlisted for military service. These were men who knew their business. I should add that on the colonial frontier, in the rougher areas sort of west and north of Massachusetts, the percentage of men with combat experience approached 80% or even more. In these kinds of frontier zones, places where people are accustomed to war, combat is merely an interlude between day-to-day hardships and the necessity to just get by. Particularly so when battles of the time lasted less than a day. As I said, Bunker Hill lasted just a couple of hours. And skirmishing is usually brief and scattered. Participants follow the biblical Job in assuming that, quote, the life of man upon earth is a warfare, and his days are like the days of a hireling, end quote. And so we find little evidence that the baptism of fire played any role among the younger militiamen at Bunker Hill. They just didn't find themselves transformed or self-realized by the experience. I mean, they went along because they thought it would be kind of interesting and fun. Or they went along, as I describe in the book, because, you know, all their relatives went along and dad went along, so everyone, that was just what you did. Indeed, the complete lack of interest in the self, in the inner life of oneself, is what really stands out at Bunker Hill. Remember, we're at least a century before Freud and psychology and it's all its associated concepts of the unconscious and trauma and neuroses and drives and so on is still in the future. In other words, troops at the time simply did not understand what happened to them in war in the same way as those born later or as we would understand them. It was difficult to express their thoughts and emotions in terms meaningful to us, even if they had wished to. For those accustomed to the graphic, introspective, modern version of war diaries, letters, and memoirs, for instance, those dating from the time of Bunker Hill come across to us as curiously sparse, chilly, and unfeeling, and strangely obsessed, again, to us, by, you know, a sort of a tedious cataloging of the names of their colonels, the times they went to church, and whether it rained or showered. There is an uncomplaining acceptance of death, hardship, and scarcity, not surprising given their routine experiencing of cold, hunger, pain, sickness, and cruelty during peacetime. They simply did not value those personal experiences that we in future centuries would consider interesting. For instance, Amos Foster, who was at Bunker Hill, he wrote in his diary of the battle, the following day, and quote, "I saw a good deal, and I remember a good deal, but it's not worth writing that I know of," end quote. That was the sort of sum total of his Bunker Hill experience. And then he just got back to everyday life as if nothing had happened. A generation or two later, and it's a completely different story. By then, the Romantic movement had taken over the world. This originally literary, philosophical, and poetic endeavor broke free of the Enlightenment's, the 18th century Enlightenment's, straight-jacketed rationalism and tightly wound obsession with outward form and control. Instead, Romantics focused on introspection, the self, and powerful emotions. It was only now, from about 1800 onwards that soldiers began to believe that everything they'd achieved in civilian life up to that moment, the challenges they had faced, and all their book learning were worthless and empty against, when measured against, a single instant of combat. An early example of this new outlook is provided by John Malcolm, who was a young Callao officer in 1813, 1814, who on the eve of his first battle was advised by his worldlier comrades that, in quote, quote, "In less than 24 hours hence, I might be wiser than all the sages and philosophers that ever wrote," end quote. And it's certainly not a coincidence, I think, that the very phrase baptism of fire, which is used in its military sense, was coined in 1822, right at the peak of the Romantic era. By the time of the Civil War, soldiers were fascinated, accordingly, by their own feelings and passions towards the phenomenon of combat. To them, imagination, impulse, intuition, and the irrational were key to war. The dramatic was exalted, the intense celebrated, horror described, the sublime marveled at. In tones that would have been incomprehensible to those at Bunker Hill, John West, a Texas private, devoted no fewer than 3 letters to his 4-year-old son, his wife, and his brother, detailing at great length his own baptism of fire at Gettysburg, which was an evidently transcendent event for him. And compare the awed reaction of Cyrus Boyd, a diarist of the time, to the stiffness of Amos Foster when he wrote in his diary of his combat experience during the war, quote, "I do not want to see any more such scenes, and yet I would not have missed this for any consideration," end quote. Seeing the elephant, as the Civil War phrase had it, was bloody awful, and yet made him feel more human, intensely human. It is only, therefore, relatively recently that we have come to regard war as a means of sampling the extremes of what it means to be human. For combat encompasses unadulterated terror and grinding boredom, unstinting comradeship and man being wolf to man, barbarism and unexpected virtue. Now, here's Sergeant Belavia again, from Iraq, the Iraq campaign a few years ago, speaking in a tenor that seems to reflect eternal truths, but is in fact quite a modern idea, as I've described. Quote, "Combat distilled to its purest human form is a test of manhood, and what a man finds there defines how he measures himself for the rest of his life. I embrace the battle. I welcome it into my soul," end quote. Now, Amos Foster, our erstwhile Bunker Hill militiaman and diarist, would be utterly confused and confounded by such a sentiment. It would simply make no sense to him. Conversely, John West, the Gettysburg soldier, would come closer to getting it, especially if Belavia's words were stripped of their genderized and secularized language of masculinity, you know, manhood and so on, and replaced by that of typically 19th century Christian imagery. Thus, Belavia's test of manhood would become instead a test of one's piety and willingness to suffer to gain redemption. Even within the relatively short time span of the United States then, today's soldiers see the world radically differently from those of the past. That affects how they act and react in war, and in turn how they interpret, understand, and personalize their combat experience. A soldier of one era or locale is not, put simply, perfectly interchangeable with another. For instance, today's Marine is only superficially similar to a Greek hoplite or a Norse Viking. Much more separates them than unites them. They have utterly alien worldviews, mentalities, and outlooks. An ancient Greek or Viking, for instance, would find something like PTSD utterly baffling. I mean, what he would ask, you know, what on earth is trauma? What is stress? And what in Zeus's or Odin's name is a disorder? And American soldiers would find the generations-long blood feuds of the Norsemen or the brutally aristocratic and autocratic world the Greeks fought for similarly bewildering. In short, war just ain't what it used to be. The fighting experience throughout history cannot be viewed and understood from a single unchanging perspective. Combat, in fact, is dynamic, not static. Combat, in its almost infinite complexity, is typified by variety, diversity, contradiction, and evolution. So rightly speaking, then, there is not one face of battle, and that's where I think Keegan got it slightly wrong. It's not an immutable, one face of battle, but numberless ones. There's not one experience of combat, but many experiences of combat. And that means that we have to discuss the soldiers of the past on their terms, not on ours. To make things even trickier, combat itself is like entering a dark room, one where monsters lurk, unexpected obstacles lay, and one can only stumble about blindly, hoping for the best. In that dark room, even the simplest thing becomes very hard. Obvious solutions become paradoxes, and straightforward questions, riddles. And ultimately, that's what my book is about. It tries to shine a light into that very dark room. It tries to discover those elusive faces of battles, to capture the souls of battles past, and to render them intelligible to today's readers. And I'll finish the talk here by bringing us back to the question with which we opened. And that is, why don't rational armies run away? The answer is that soldiers themselves, in the very midst of combat, understand fully what they're involved in. There's a silverish clarity to the madness surrounding them. To outsiders, of course, combat still looks irrational. But to those in the fray, in the field, at the supreme moment of crisis, in the instant that one's mettle will be tested as never before, right then, yes, it does all make sense to every man, and increasingly woman, of war. And in the end, that is why rational armies do not run away. And that, too, as I hope I've demonstrated partly this evening, is what makes the study of soldiers under fire endlessly fascinating. And thank you for listening.
You talk about PTSD and how alien it would seem to the ancient or medieval warrior. Well, it seems to me that, okay, a medieval or ancient battle, the armies mustered, they marched together, there was one resounding clash of hand-to-hand combat, and then it was over.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas once firearms came into combat, battles could last for hours, days even, with continual shock, trauma going on and on and on. And I would think that there were battles in the 1600s that lasted for 2.5 days sometimes, people just endlessly exchanging volleys. That experience strikes me as much more likely to produce the sort of reaction that we are accustomed to in our modern, and or even in the 19th century, 18th mm-hmm. century, firearms battles. Do you think, does that make any sense to you? Do you think if...
Well, it makes a lot of sense to me. That one of the reasons why there's been an increase in PTSD, I mean, well, there's several reasons, one of which is, better understanding of it, more resources devoted to studying it and so forth. A prime reason, as they discovered during the Second World War, is the length of battles. How long you're under, at the time was known as combat stress. And I think it was they discovered that various social scientists were assigned to study this this phenomenon of soldiers breaking down on Iwo or in Europe and so on. And they basically said that as you go into battle, I think your combat efficiency reaches a peak after about. I'm just trying to remember offhand, but so don't quote me on this. After 30 days, and after that, it kind of goes down bit by bit. And after about 90 days, you're virtually useless until you get, revolved to the back, and then you take some rest and you can come back. So it's the constant stress, the grind, that really provokes a lot of disorder. They found that again in the Pacific, there was the famous 1,000-yard stare or the 2,000-yard stare, whereby Marines or soldiers would begin becoming almost like zombies. There was this sort of listless staring into space, and it just meant that through sheer exhaustion, sheer stress over many, many weeks of fighting, they were just basically burnt out. Some of the time they could be just taken to the back to go deal with food service for a couple of days, and then they would come back and they were fine. Other ones, if they'd gone too far, we had to be evacuated and they would end up in a sort of a psychiatric hospital of some kind. I talk about that a lot in the book, in the Iwo Jima chapter. But to get back more to what you're saying, the fact is it's also a question of how soldiers understood what they were going through. And say, in a lot of battles, there weren't that many battles that lasted 2.5 days. And also soldiers were revolving in and out, in and out, in and out all the time. They weren't constantly under stress. In a firearms battle of the 17th century, for instance, you were pretty safe if you were, a couple of hundred yards back. Nothing was going to hit you. Maybe an errant cannonball occasionally came whizzing past. But by and large, you were quite safe there was a sort of a distinct front line and a rear area. So, you know, I think it's and again, soldiers at the time wouldn't really, as I sort of I try to get into, they don't really understand what they're going through. So that it can be classified in all sorts of different ways, that are almost alien to us. For instance, it could put down to, you know, obviously cowardice. That's a big one for someone who suddenly starts almost shirking the field. So again, it's very, very, and as I discussed in the Bunker Hill chapter, it's very, very hard to, at this, where we are now, to actually evaluate objectively the incidence of disorder or PTSD cases in the past. In the Bunker Hill chapter, I pick up a couple of mentions in letters. But again, it's always very ambiguous. There was a diary entry, I remember, of the British who took colossal losses at Bunker Hill. And there was a fellow a few months later who, one of his fellow captains mentioned, last night slit his throat. Now, that could be anything. That could be maybe he was a depressive. He'd been disinherited by his father. We don't know. Or it could be that he was quite wounded, or he was completely disturbed by what he'd seen, and he became suicidal. It could be any number of factors. So, yeah, to get back to your point, there is PTSD in the past. We just don't know quite how to define it or how common it was. But I think it was much less than it is in the 20th century, when battles really began to extend in terms of time, and there was a dissolution of the traditional boundaries between the front and the front and the rear.
A follow-up about PTS. The portion at the end of your Gettysburg part where you're talking about the soldiers after the fighting stopped,
mm-hmm.
and the two studies that you footnote about the 17,000 veterans studied and the correlation mm-hmm. between if their company suffered a large number of KIA and mm-hmm. the correlation to the number of physical and psychological impact in the years following.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about finding those two sources and how it affected your overall understanding of soldiers after the combat.
Great question. It's these were academic studies, I think I found in various journals. I can't remember the exact sources. Mostly in medical journals, you know, where someone actually put together analyses of old soldiers' homes and things like drug use after the Civil War. It's very, very interesting, actually. And large parts of New England and so on were actually given over by the 1890s to huge opium farming, mostly to supply old soldiers' homes where apparently drug or opiate abuse was actually quite rampant at the time. Again, it's almost a forgotten footnote to history, that. It's very interesting. I was most interested with Gettysburg to find out the aftermath of what happens to soldiers. It's all very well to hear about all the, you know, the glory days of, you know, the blue and the gray and, you know, moonlight and magnolias, stuff about the Civil War. But it's also very interesting to find out what happened to these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men who didn't make it back in one piece, either mentally or physically. I find it very interesting, you know, these correlations between this, drug use, what these scholars found was that, as you said, there was, if your unit was heavily engaged at Gettysburg or at any of the big Civil War battles, then there was you were much more likely to be sicker, unhealthier, poorer, more unbalanced after the war. And so it's a very interesting correlation. And I think, you know, that sort of lesson is probably applicable to, you know, the current, World War I, World War II, and the current wars, well, the recently finished wars.
Just a point of information. I always thought the Battle of Bunker Hill was actually fought on Breed's Hill, and I wonder how it got the name the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Oh, well, very good question. I actually met Henry Breed once at a conference, who is related to Mr. Breed of Breed's Hill, who insisted that it was actually Breed's Hill. And he was very, very put out when I kept on referring to it as Bunker Hill. And, you know, as I would be. The basic reason, it's very simple. There was a mix-up. There are two hills on that peninsula. There's a Bunker and a Breed's. And the actual real fighting did indeed happen on Breed's Hill, but on the maps and, you know, in various reports, it was misreported as Bunker Hill. And the Bunker Hill stuck. So Mr. Bunker, whoever he was, sort of goes down in history, and Mr. Breed sort of fades into nothingness, unfortunately. But again, it was just a mistake. I just prefer the traditional term. That was all. Like I always say in the book, Pickett's Charge, though it's now, what is it, the Pettigrew, Trimble, something-something charge. Yeah, it's. I just prefer Pickett's Charge just because it's, I don't know, it's more vivid, I think. I don't know quite why.
While doing your research, did you come across cases where troops were supplied with huge amounts of alcohol before going into battle?
Oh, not really. That's a little bit of a myth about the whole Dutch courage thing. Mostly because most commanders don't want their troops drunk before they go into battle. It's usually not a good idea. I didn't really find a lot at, say, Gettysburg. What they did instead was, I think, what some of the Confederates did, or was rumored amongst the Union guys, was they would... I think they took tobacco and mixed it with a bit of gunpowder, and they would chew it, which must have... which must have been just awful, but apparently it really, really got you going. But yeah, very little amount, very little stories of the actual alcohol drinking. Again, I was surprised. And again, I think on Iwo Jima was probably quite difficult to come by. I mean, you were in the middle of nowhere. On the other hand, you know, you could smoke as much as you liked. So, and I think there's a statistic in there I found that just going to Iwo Jima, the U.S. Navy shipped in 1 million cigarettes just for a single division. So, you know, someone was smoking up a storm there if they weren't drinking. Actually, the interesting on Iwo Jima, the favored cocktail was pineapple juice, not booze. And the reason was that they were all constipated because of the rations, and pineapple juice apparently released everything quite violently. And there's a great story of a guy who drank some pineapple juice, and then just after he finished it, the Japanese opened up with a huge mortar barrage just as he was pulling down his pants. And so he, as he said, he joined in the chorus of artillery. And then he ran back to this little foxhole, and he said, I couldn't touch pineapple juice for the next 40 years. So, any other? Oh.
Besides the obvious differences in combat mechanics and arrows, did you see any differences with these battles being fought at the very beginning, the middle, or more or less at the tail end of the conflict?
Not particularly. I mean, it sort of worked out that way, that it was beginning, middle, end. It was a very sort of happy sort of three-act play. You know, my own view is that I mean, I sort of get into it a little bit. I think, you know, at the beginning, and you'd probably say this about any war, it's sort of kind of a weird hypothesis, and it really doesn't quite stand up to scrutiny, but I'll just say it anyway. You know, at the beginning of a war, you know, armies are all quite inexperienced. It's that whole cliche of, you know, the armies are fighting the last war. as they go on, as the Marines did at Iwo Jima, and I talk about this, it's one of the themes of the Iwo Jima chapter is how armies learn to fight and how they adapt to changing realities and circumstances. And so by the end of the war, and I discussed this in Iwo Jima about U.S. Marines or Army policy tactics versus the Japanese during the Pacific War. You know, we tend to assume that the Japanese are these sort of faceless sort of automatons who are just kind of there to be slaughtered. And one of the reasons for that is that generally they were slaughtered, and so there's not many diarists or letter writers left. In the Iwo Jima, I was trying to get into the mindset of the Japanese. You know, how were they reacting? I mean, they just didn't sort of sit there and wait to be machine gunned or flamethrowed to death. You know, they're not idiots. And it's quite interesting, over the 2 or 3 years before Iwo Jima, Japanese high command is adapting. They are for every island that the Americans are advancing, the Japanese are changing their tactics. Sometimes they allow the Americans to land unimpeded on the beaches, as they did at Iwo Jima. That was the fad at the time. Other times they would try and push them off before they got to the beach. Other times they would hole up in a cave. Other times they would come out and do banzai assaults. So they're changing. They're trying to work out. And the Marines, of course, and the Army were also adapting, mostly through intelligence acquisition. The U.S. intelligence was desperate for any kind of Japanese papers, any kind of letters, any kind of orders, anything like that, that the soldiers would pick up on the islands to be sent back to be translated. And they would be going through them about learning about Japanese tactics and little tricks like, you know, booby traps and all that sort of stuff. So the U.S. was picking up a colossal amount of intelligence about the enemy, and the Japanese were picking up almost none. And over time as well, you know, American perceptions of the Japanese was shifting as well. You know, at the beginning of the war, you know, you have the sort of, you know, that cliche about, you know, that sort of bespectacled race of little people, you know, sort of verminous monkeys and all that kind of thing who couldn't fight their way out of a wet paper bag. And then, of course, I think, 11 divisions of the Japanese army just rolled over most of Asia. And so that changed pretty quickly. And, you know, any Marine who landed at Okinawa or Iwo Jima or anything like that, thinking that he was up against a bunch of little tiny wimps, would have been dead within about 5 minutes. So, you know, Marines had a lot of respect for the Japanese. And so, you know, what I go into in the chapter, to get back to your question, is that at the end of the war, the Americans have changed completely from Guadalcanal. So the Americans have changed their tactics completely, their way of thinking. They had new weapons. For instance, at the beginning of the war, the Americans had no flamethrowers or anything like that. I mean, zero. Or very few heavy machine guns, or light machine guns for that matter. They weren't considered to be used, needed. By Iwo Jima, they were being outfitted all over the place with these weapons. Not because, as I talk about in the book, you know, the racist angle. It's mostly instrumentalist. Is that, you know, if you have people in a cave, holed up in a cave, there's no real other way to get them out of that cave if they're unwilling to surrender. You have to exterminate them. There's no other way to do it. And that's why you get these very high kill ratios on these Pacific islands, where the fighting was so awful. And as for the Japanese, my view is that they didn't just refuse to surrender. A lot of the time, they didn't quite know what was going on themselves. Remember, the Americans on Iwo Jima had very few communications. I mean, you could be one unit here, and about 20 yards away, there'd be some other unit. You wouldn't even know their names. I mean, you wouldn't know what they were doing. You would just keep on going, plowing forward, doing your bit day by day by day. Japanese too. I mean, there's some records of, you know, it would take at least an hour or two, and three runners to get a simple message from one Japanese position to another half a mile away. It was just because they were always being killed, or there were no wires because they were all mushed up by the American artillery. So the Japanese are all in a mess themselves. A lot of the time they actually don't know that they're losing. This idea. We assume, why are these idiots fighting? I mean, don't they know this is over before it began? And in fact, it's not to their minds. They think that they've still got a good chance here, and that the Americans are, you know. I think Kurubayashi actually reported back to Tokyo that most of the American Navy was sunk, you know, off of Iwo Jima, and that he believed that. You're dealing with a lot of misconceptions. And anyways, this is a very roundabout way of getting back to your question, which is, yeah, there are differences between beginnings, middles, and ends of wars. And by the end of the war, you know, the armies are at their peak. They've climbed the the learning curve. And it's usually a very steep learning curve that's unfortunately paid with blood.
So you mentioned in your introduction to your book and the introduction to tonight's talk that you chose these battles because they're iconic, and when you deal with icons, you deal with mythology. Did you find yourself doing any myth-busting while you were writing this book? Did you find something out that really surprised you?
Well, a lot of things really surprised me. There is some myth-busting, some of which I just alluded to. There's a very popular idea that that race was the critical factor in the Pacific War. And in fact, it actually wasn't. As I said, it was an instrumental. It was mostly an instrumental war. I'm trying to think what else. I mean, it was just, I think that the main myth that I was trying to confront in, say, the Gettysburg chapter, or indeed all of the chapters, if you think about it, is that people, you know, of the past weren't stupid. For instance, we naturally think you watch a movie, a great movie like Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, or The Patriot, which was not as great. And what you find is that you, or even of a Gettysburg, the famous Gettysburg movie several years ago, you'll often see just one line of guys here and one line of guys here, and they kind of just walk slowly at each other, and musket shots ring out, and a couple of guys fall over, but everyone just keeps walking indomitably on, and you think, what's gotten into them? Why would you do that? Why don't they take cover? Why not run a little bit faster? It doesn't seem to make any sense to us. But to people at the time, these tactics have a kind of a vocabulary. They have a grammar and a logic all to themselves. And that is that generally these tactics are the most sensible way of conducting these battles, given the constraints of the time. One of the myths I was dealing with Gettysburg was this, to blow up this idea that everyone was stupid. And just marched at each other and got slaughtered because that was just how it worked. It's not really like that. These tactics, as I described in here, if they were well executed, would work wonders. The whole sort of mechanism of 19th and mostly 18th century warfare too is that you need to have mass and momentum. And that is, you need to keep your men in a straight line, which is itself, as I talk about in the book, actually very difficult to do. You try keeping 500 guys in a straight line walking at a certain pace over 100 yards. It's very, very hard to do without really good training. And hence all the emphasis on discipline and drill in the 18th and 19th centuries. Basically war was entropy. So from the second that you lined up your men and started advancing towards the enemy, your line would begin to dissolve no matter how well trained it was. And so you had to keep your men together and to keep the mass, and you had to keep on going with momentum. And eventually, hopefully, you would get three-quarters of the way there, and then the defenders would break because you were so sort of indomitable. That was how it worked in principle, of course. And it's important because the minute that men started taking cover, as we would naturally think they should, that's when your line broke up. And a line that broke up in the 19th century in any of these Civil War battles, these early Civil War battles, you were dead. That was it. The cavalry would come sweeping through and you'd be finished. So again, these tactics make sense at the time. And again, a lot of it comes down to how well executed they are. One of the reasons why there was so much bloodshed during the Civil War is actually not really owing to the tactics. It's really owing to lack of ability by certain officers who, remember, only a few months before, a lot of the time, had been cobblers or school teachers or students or whatever they were. And same with their men. This was not Napoleon's Imperial Guard. It was very difficult to articulate and synchronize various wings of a battalion or a brigade and make the regiments all work together perfectly as Napoleon's marshals could do using their own initiative. So in the Civil War, it's basically, all right, don't really know what to do. We've only had a month of training. Right, line them up, go, and try and keep them together, and hopefully we'll make it. So that's how it worked. It was basically almost a sort of a lack of training. As time goes on, and certain officers really worked out how to make men move properly, and you would often see that they would actually achieve their objectives. These great bloody frontal assaults became frontal assaults or assaults that actually worked. I think the great, almost unheard of, Emory Upton, was one of the pioneers of this, of actually using men properly and using, different, rather complicated tactics. And he would, I think, nearly always achieve his objectives. So that's a very long and digressive answer to a very simple question. I apologize.
In the research did for this book, did you uncover anything about the role of peer pressure in motivating a soldier to do his duty as opposed to turning and running when he was under duress?
Yeah, that's sort of group cohesion, small group cohesion. It was sort of developed in the 20th century as a theory that one of the reasons why soldiers actually stick together through the thick of it all is because they're with their buddies. You've got that sort of comrade the sort of bond of comrades, and this sort of close bonding between men that you don't experience in civilian life. So there is that. I think it's for the most part a 20th century phenomenon. But in Bunker Hill, and as I go into some detail explaining, and I don't think anyone's really done it before. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but I really dissect these militia companies. You know, who were a militia company at the time was about 30 or 40 men, and they were all from a certain town, you know, Lexington or somewhere in New Hampshire or wherever. And I talk about, you know, I actually look at the muster lists. You know, who were these people? And what is fascinating is that first the seniors in it, the colonels, the captains, are almost universally not the richest men of the town. You know, it wasn't like a big social thing. They were the most experienced war horses, like people like John Stark and all the other colonels and big guys at Bunker Hill. All these guys had gone through the French and Indian War, had been in at least 20 or 30 firefights. I mean, these were men who knew their business. And they would, a lot of the time, they would recruit the guys who had fought under them, you know, 20 years before. It was like almost a clan thing. They were like little war bands of tribes. And as you look at the names and lists, you would see surnames repeating. You know, there'd be like six Fosters or eight Smiths or whatever in every company. And it'd be a lot of doubles, a lot of triples. And what happened was, remember, these towns are very small and insular, and a lot of these guys are intermarried seven generations back by that time. And so basically almost everybody in a given militia company at Bunker Hill was related, intermarried by blood or marriage, or they were a business partner of someone. They were cousins. I mean, it was, you know, married to someone's brother-in-law, or sister-in-law, a sister. And so what you have is a very small, again, you have a small group cohesion. Mostly, it's one of the reasons why they stood so well at Bunker Hill. And the reason is that they're all related. They're all from the same town. And so nobody wants to be seen to be running, because then, you know, you're never going to live it down. I mean, you will be the subject of village gossip till the day you die. And most people at that time didn't travel further than, you know, 20 miles from wherever they grew up. At the same time, they were led by capable, experienced men, you know, older men who could sort of put a calming hand on their shoulder as they, you know, as the British were coming up. So to answer your question, yeah, small group cohesion is a vital factor in all combat.
Why Americans, and was there anything unique to the American experience in combat you found across the three battles you studied?
That's a great question, because that gets into styles of warfare, like ways of warfare. You know, things like, is there a German way of warfare? Is there an American way of warfare that there's sort of the genetic roots can be traced back several hundred years, or I think Victor Davis Hanson did, the Western way of warfare and that kind of thing, saying that there was a connection between today's American soldiers and the Greek hoplites. And as I mentioned in the talk, I disagree strenuously with that in many respects. About the American experience, I mean, it's sort of a banality in a way, in the sense that these are, sort of Republican, not politically, but Republican-minded. Well, some of them are, I guess, but Republican-minded soldiers. I mean, they're not generally ideological. Generally speaking, that's a very generalist statement. They're really, a lot of the time, it's about, you know, they're fighting for. They're not really, fighting for democracy a lot of the time, though you think that they are. They're fighting for personal reasons. They're fighting for, because Uncle Joe told them to, or they're doing it for a bit of adventure, or they're doing it, because they were called up, or again, they sort of believe in the Union or the Confederacy. So it's kind of a confused answer, but it's I find it very difficult to trace these like very strong threads going back 300 or 400 years and saying, you know, the guy at Bunker Hill is exactly the same as the guy at Iwo Jima or at Fallujah. I always find that a little bit reductive. So I'm still musing on it, as you can tell by this very confused and roundabout answer, which I'm sort of desperately trying to impress you all, but with big words, but it's not working. So I apologize for that. I'm not a big fan of the way of warfare theory. I think people are too individual to be, and they have there's such a large myriad of reasons why people actually go to war, to actually say, you know, that this is you know, that they're all genetically related. Thank you.
Our thanks to Alexander Rose for this important discussion and to Random House for sponsoring this program. The book is Men of War, The American Soldier in Combat at Bunker Hill, Gettysburg, and Iwo Jima, published by Random House. To learn more about the book, our sponsors, or the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at PritzkerMilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. If you would like to be a part of our studio audience, become a member, or learn more, visit PritzkerMilitary.org. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.